Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you tonight?
Chris, I am doing just fine. I hope you are.
As we were discussing off mic, I am out of it. I was sitting here wondering why I couldn't hear you wearing headphones that were not plugged in anything for about 10 minutes.
That sounds like the premise to a music video.
9 years I've been doing this. 9 years. And that was me tonight.
Have we gotten to our Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours yet? I don't know.
It somehow feels much, much longer.
Doesn't it? We hope you don't feel like it's been 10,000 hours. Because when you're having fun, it feels like a mere instant. And we are going to have some fun on this week's show.
We do have a good one. We've got a good one this week. I can feel it in my bones.
Our guest is the returning Michel Fiffet, who is going to be talking to us about his upcoming run on the new Bloodstrike series that he's doing.
Heck yes.
So get ready. Get ready to hear about some brutalists. That is something we're going to be talking to him about, as well as his other work. So hang around for that. But Chris, before we do that,
yes,
we have some business to take care of, starting with thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. That is what we're going to do. These are the people who have gone all the way down to 405 Gimmick Street. They've logged on to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they've kicked in as little as $1 a month to help the show keep going.
The Patreon supporter has logged on.
That's the Twitter name that you should get off of this week's episode. The_Patreon_supporter.
You could just be the patron, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that is what a Patreon supporter is called. That's hence the name.
We've gotten quite a few edited pledges over the past week. Mm-hmm. One new pledge, which came from Mike McFall.
Well, thank you, Mike.
If you would like to be like Mike, and who doesn't want to be like Mike, you can head over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kick in as little as $1 a month to help us keep the lights on here, and you will get cool stuff, including ad-free episodes of every episode of every show that we do. That's this show, Movie Fighters, Snack Situation, the Every Story Ever specials, ad-free. You get them on the Patreon feed. People at additional levels get stuff like bonus audio, which we've been posting a lot of lately. They get stuff like physical rewards. They get line-stepping privileges for the list that we do. T-shirts, new t-shirts just went out to the domestic patrons at a certain level. The international patrons at that level will be getting their shirts in the very, very near future as well. So if any of that sounds cool to you, head on over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and help us out a little bit.
They are not going to stop sending these gimmicks in the mail called bills, let me tell you.
It'll never happen. They
show up every week.
Happen. Well, speaking of stuff that happens during the week, Chris, let's do some checks and wrecks. Chris, what do you have to check in with this week?
Matt, I have some updates on previous checks and wrecks. That's right. It's hot breaking news on things that the rest of you were probably into a year ago. But yes, the first thing I want to talk about is my check this week, which is that I devoted a lot of time to finally finishing The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And when I say finishing, I mean I did it all. It took me quite a while, but I finally got Link looking like Link, which is a very important thing to me. I had to get him in that green hat that green shirt, those shorts. I had to get that sword right. I had to get that shield right.
And if you don't have an amiibo with that costume, it's quite a task to do that.
Yeah, you have to finish every shrine, of which there are a great deal.
Quite a few.
It's like 120, I think.
Yeah.
Plus I did all the DLC, so I did the Master Sword trials, so that you can always have the sweet powered-up Master Sword. And I did the other DLC, which ends with you getting a dirt bike. Now, Matt, have you played this dirt bike DLC for The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild?
I have not. I have not played any of the DLC for Breath of the Wild.
Brother, let me tell you. The Master Trials DLC is fun. The Champions Ballad DLC is great because it adds in basically 4 new boss fights, because you kind of refight all of the Divine Beasts versions of Ganon. You also get 12 new shrines, because you get 3 for each champion. But then you get like an additional Divine Beast style dungeon that you have to get through. And that's all fun. But at the end of it, you do get a dirt bike. A straight up, like, unicorn-headed dirt bike that you can drive off mountains and land and be okay, that runs on monster parts.
Oh, very good. Very, yeah. Very good.
You gotta put, like, moblin horns in it to keep it going.
Well, I had, like, 500 of those in my inventory by the time I finished the game, so it would be handy to use those for something.
Yeah. The only problem is that you can only get to that stuff once you've been through the actual 4 Divine Beasts. So it's pretty late in the game by that point, especially because I did all the shrines first because I wanted Link to look like Link. It was very important to me that he wear his real clothes, much in the same way that I read comics. And I'm like, why wasn't Superman wearing his real clothes from 2011 to 2018? I want Link to look like Link. So I got that. I got the dirt bike and then basically rode it in to fight Ganon at the end. But it was still very, very fun. And I finally got to beat the game. The last time I played it, I stopped before I actually beat the game. So that last boss fight is pretty dope.
It is. It's good. It's, if you have done all 4 Divine Beasts, it makes it sort of easy compared to the bosses in the Divine Beasts, I feel like, the elemental versions of Ganon. But it is a fun boss fight.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I got to it, I was a god bestriding the earth.
Yeah.
With you know, I had a bow that shot 5 arrows at once, which I didn't know was a thing in the game. I thought it only went up to 3. But yeah, Breath of the Wild, a truly amazing game from last year. But yeah, that's what I've been devoting a lot of my downtime to. Matt, how about you? What's your check this week?
My check is that, look, don't tell anybody.
Okay.
But this Friday is my birthday.
Oh my God, Matt, that's right, it's June.
That's right. Birthday time for me. I'm sure I'll do something fun. And if anybody's interested in, you know, helping me out for my birthday, giving me a little gift, I'm not going to share my Amazon wish list. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. There are 2 things I'm going to ask for. One is to go back through our charities that we have highlighted on the show in the past several months and just contribute to one of them. However much you feel comfortable contributing, that would be super cool. The other thing you can do is to help get the word out about my brand new comic, Everything Will Be Okay. It is out now on Comixology. The first issue is up and available for purchase now. Comixology was cool enough to both tweet about it and put a post on their Tumblr about it the day it came out, which was mega awesome. I am so grateful for that. Thank you to Comixology for doing that. Because that doesn't happen for every Comixology submit title, I'll tell you that much. So it was nice to get a little special attention there. I feel like I said this on my Twitter today, like, cards on the table. I really deeply hope that this comic gets the attention of some editors who say, hey, maybe I could hire Matt to write a thing for me. I think it should immediately lead to editors slash publishers picking up the talents of Rodrigo Vargas, Joe Hunter, and Josh Kroc, who absolutely kill it on that book. So it has the goods in there, if not from the writing, certainly from the art and the lettering. So if you want to help me out for my birthday and give me a little something to celebrate the day of my birth, tell everybody who you know who is interested in comics to check out Everything Will Be Okay on Comixology, because I'm super proud of it and I want more people to read it.
And Matt, we should say, number one is currently available on Comixology, but if you were a Kickstarter backer, which I was, then you have gotten digital versions of up to issue 4?
Yes, 4 out of the 5 issues are out to the Kickstarter backers.
So there,
5 is being drawn currently.
So there are plenty of people who have already read the next 3 issues of this comic that can tell you how good it is. And I will tell you, I love it. I think it is genuinely some of not just your strongest comics work, but honestly one of the best things going right now. It's really good. The first 3 are really good. The 4th one gets into some really emotional content that I thought was stellar from you. So
thank you, Chris. That is coming from you. That is high praise. Thank you so much.
That was your birthday present.
That's about right. Yeah. But I feel like the first 3 issues set up that stuff that's in the 4th issue, that kind of gut punch that comes in the 4th issue. I am happy about that. I will say the 5th issue goes to entirely different wild places.
I'm really excited.
Get ready.
Because I don't know where it's going to go. Like, the first 4 issues are so different from each other while still maintaining that through line. And Rodrigo is great. Joe's great. Josh is great. I've worked with Joe and Josh before on stuff, and I love working with those dudes. So they make for a really, really good comic.
Yeah. Each, without giving too much away, essentially each issue becomes a different genre. And issue 5 is no different. It does something very wild, very wild. All right, Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
I'm going to follow up on my rec from last time. I want to talk about Westworld.
Westworld Redux.
Yeah, I'm into season 2 now, son.
As am I. You might be further along than I am, because I believe I've watched 3 episodes of season 2 at this point.
I believe we watched the 3rd one tonight, so I think we're right at the same spot, because we're catching up with old HBO Go on through, or HBO through Amazon Prime, I guess is what it is. I was really surprised at how much I liked it. I thought that first season was really, really well done. Evan Rachel Wood is incredible on that show.
Yeah, I can't believe we talked about all the acting in the show last week without talking about Evan Rachel Wood, who is shockingly convincing as a humanoid automaton.
Yeah. She's incredible. And it's weird how you don't realize that she is the star of the show until late in that first season.
Until maybe the very end of season 1.
Yeah.
She is kind of the building block from which the cornerstone of the show.
Yeah.
And then also we didn't mention Tandy Newton, who is also fantastic. Yeah.
Well, last week when we talked, I hadn't really gotten to the Tandy Newton stuff, the stuff with Maeve. And she, like, first of all, everybody on that show is really great. Tandy Newton and Evan Rachel Wood are wonderful actors and crush it on that show. And I think one of the reasons that we didn't talk a lot about Evan Rachel Wood last time is that she comes off as so absolutely natural in that role that when there is, and I will try not to spoil it, but there is a slight shift in what she is and what she does by the end of that first season. And into season 2, if you're not caught up and you want to get caught up, skip ahead a little bit. Matt, I love her supervillain voice. She has that. Like, and when she, there are scenes where she shifts between the Dolores voice and the straight up Dr. Doom voice that she has.
Yeah.
Evan Rachel Wood for Dr. Doom. That's where I'm at right now.
I'm in. But I also, my favorite scenes with her are actually the ones where she's sort of in like maintenance mode, right? And like Jeffrey Wright is calibrating her.
Yes.
And so she's kind of talking in a robot voice, or like as robot-y as anybody gets on the show. Mm-hmm. And she is utterly convincing as like a non-human entity. In the moment of the show, you're just kind of like in it, right? But if you step back from it, you're like, that's a person pretending to not be a person.
Yes.
And like,
that's a person pretending to not be a person who's pretending to be a person.
Yeah.
And it's never, and it, the thing is, it's never not that. Those performances are never not layered like that in that show.
It's true.
I talked about last week, Jeffrey Wright, who we love, who is, he is up there with Jitimo as in our weird list of favorites we've acquired over doing this show.
Him and Jitimo and Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa, and yeah, those are our guys.
That's a fucking cast right yeah, there. Yeah, boy. I said tonight, in season two, he constantly looks like he can't remember if he left the oven on. So he's just like looking over his glasses and looking around very shiftily in a very particular way. But apart from the really, really good acting and really, really good character work, I just love how that show is full-on video game physics every time they're in the park, and how you get this show where it's got complex acting and it's, you know, about the nature of humanity and the creation of life and who does this world belong to, and then sometimes someone will get shot and their head will explode.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of the park changes in season two without giving it away, but it still has a lot of that going on.
The Men in Black stuff in season two, where he is now like, he is the best guy at this live action video game and is now playing like survival mode. Like he got the DLC.
He's doing a second playthrough.
He's doing fucking second quest. He's doing New Game Plus.
He's doing New Game Plus.
I talk about this all the time. You know that video for Roll Call, the Lil Jon song, where Ice Cube's raking his yard? Yeah. And then he goes in and gets his Raiders cap from the secret Batcave under his bed. I love that image. That happens on this show with the Man in Black. And then the first thing he does is he literally like goes and picks up HP, and then he goes and punches a wall and finds a med kit. He fucking Castlevanias it immediately.
Yeah, that does happen.
Yeah, Westworld's a fucking ride, man. It is a good romp. I am glad that I am into it now.
You remember that last week I said, if you asked me what season one was about, I couldn't tell you. And that is because by the end of it, season one is just such a maelstrom, right? There's so many things going on at once. And it's trying to be this like big action show with like big dramatic beats, and also be like very thematically dense with like the stuff about the nature of humanity. There's a part of me that wishes that like the heavy philosophical stuff would just kind of be like, yeah, that's in here. But mostly this is just a show where like people's heads blow up. Mm-hmm. There's a part of me that wishes they would kind of drop the big philosophical intellectual pretense of the show. But I understand that's part of the appeal.
I think it really works, because here, you know, recently Aiden and I, we caught up all on Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones is trash. It's good. Yeah. It's well made. I like it. I liked it way more than I thought I was going to, but it is trash. It is the gap between Game of Thrones and Xena Warrior Princess is a hair.
We've said it before. Game of Thrones is essentially a very, very high budget soap opera.
Yeah, it's super fun. Westworld, I think, is actually like really is smart. Like, it actually really is saying some things and also doing like all the violent delights and weird video game physics that you know, it's commenting on like the nature of video games without being hand-wringing about it, I think, is really fun. Because they never come out and say like, oh yeah, this is what video games are in the future. But it's clear just from the way things work that's what it is.
One thing I will say.
Yes.
It has that Nolan thing. Because one of the Nolans is involved in Westworld. Not
Jonathan.
Christopher Jonathan. It has that Nolan thing where it is very clever and quite smart, but once you start peeling away at the edges, you see a lot of the artifice, which is true of, I'd say, most Nolan things, which is not to devalue its intelligence or its craft.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try to deconstruct it, you notice the seams. That's my criticism of it, but that doesn't mean it's not a good show, and it doesn't mean that I am also not enjoying it.
Don't fucking Pax Americana it, man.
Don't take
the dog apart see how he works. It's also very Nolan in that there is a dude who only talks like this.
Yeah.
We're looking at you over his glasses. But I fucking love Jeffrey Wright. He's so good.
Man, Jeffrey Wright talking like this.
Jeffrey Wright wearing his glasses wrong.
The best talking like this that there ever was.
I don't have to look through my lenses. Matt, what is your recommendation this week?
My recommendation is a show where people eat a hot chicken wings.
Go on.
I've mentioned it on the show before. It's called Hot Ones. It's a YouTube show. It's been on for several seasons now. I believe the sixth season is about to start. And it is a show where Sean Evans, an interviewer / reporter from Complex Media, sits down in front of 10 chicken wings along with a celebrity. They have on a lot of actors and actresses, but they also have on a lot of like musicians, rappers, DJs. There's a good number of people on that show who I'm like, who the fuck is that? And then I find out they're extremely popular. A lot of those people are like DJs and people. They have on celebrity chefs. They have on like YouTube celebrities and people like that. And they just eat increasingly hot wings up to sauce made out of the hottest pepper on earth. Pepper
X. Matt, are you talking about Megadeth Liquid Rage? Oh, I couldn't get through it.
They do. Okay. At one point, Megadeth sauce with Liquid Rage was the hottest sauce on the show. Now the hottest sauce on the show is The Last Dab, which is made by Hot Ones. It's their own sauce. And it's made with Pepper X, the hottest pepper on earth, which was concocted by a guy who lives in Rock Hill, South Carolina.
Yeah. How wild is it that the hottest pepper in the world comes from just the North Carolina, South Carolina border over by Charlotte?
Yeah, a Charlotte suburb is where Smokin' Ed is making the hottest peppers on the planet. Because he had also developed the Carolina Reaper, which was before that the hottest pepper in the world.
Which is your nickname.
That's right. Yes, me, Carolina Reaper. Anyway, Hot Ones is very fun. It's very enjoyable to watch. And what's extra fun is to watch the show and figure out if the guest is going to lean into getting fucked up by the heat, mm-hmm. or they're going to try to tough guy it. Like, tough it out all the way through. Because it's not always clear who's going to do what. A lot of times comedians definitely lean into, like, playing up how hot the sauces are. Like, I watched one with Bobby Lee, who you will recall from Mad TV. I watched one with him that was like, he really like played up the hotness of the wings. A lot of times, like, athletes will kind of act like it's no big deal. Or like There are other people who will act like it's no big deal up to a point, and then they'll flip out about how hot it gets. There have been like three people who have eaten the wings straight through and been totally unfazed by them. Or like almost completely unfazed by them. One was Jay Farrow, who did shockingly well with them. There was a rapper who I recently watched an episode with who like totally no-sold it, but he's not a rapper I'm super familiar with. And then Alton Brown, not only unfazed by the hot sauce, was rating them as he went by flavor.
You're talking about Georgia's Own.
Georgia's Own, Alton Brown. Like, other chefs were not as unfazed as Alton Brown. Like, Guy Fieri took it a little hard. He was sweating. Rachel Ray got pretty red in the face. Alton Brown, champ. Absolute champ going through this. But there are definitely, like, certain episodes that are really good. Generally, Sean Evans gets good answers out of whoever he's interviewing. But I'd say certain episodes are better than others. YouTube does a pretty good job of recommending the good ones as opposed to the ones that are less good. Like the one with Key and Peele is excellent. It's really fun to watch. There are a good many good other ones. One that I kept getting recommended was the Kevin Hart episode, which is weird because he keeps looking off camera to talk to people who are off camera instead of the interviewer sitting in front of him. Because Kevin Hart was already big time by that point. Oh, the Sasha Banks episode is very good. They've done two wrestler episodes.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's intriguing.
Sasha Banks was on one. She did very well. And Chris Jericho did one. He did a little less well, but still got all the way through. But those two are fun to watch. It's also fun to watch the ones where people just give up. I think there were four or five times when somebody just like completely gave up. Before they got through all 10 wings. So if you have yet to watch Hot Ones on YouTube, it is an enjoyable thing to put on while you're working kind of show, because you can just kind of listen to it. And if you hear like a moment where somebody's freaking out over the heat of the wings, you can turn and watch it. And it's good. All right, Chris, those are our checks and recs. Let's talk about some comics.
Let's do it.
Man of Steel number one is not the first Superman story of Brian Michael Bendis's that we've read, because he had a story in Action Comics number 1000, and he had a story in the DC Nation number zero book from a few weeks ago. But this is kind of the official kickoff of his run. We didn't really like the Action Comics story. We did like the DC Nation story. I would say this one kind of splits the difference between the two.
It is almost exactly down the middle. Because here's what I'll say. I am kind of genuinely surprised, and I don't mean this in a rude way, but I am genuinely surprised at how much I am enjoying Bendis writing Superman. I think he actually writes a good, like, relatable, good Superman. The only thing that I wasn't like 100% on as far as the way he wrote Superman was that I thought Superman was a little strict with that, telling that girl to not cuss. Because I think he just goes, "Language, please." And I was like, oh, well, you know, she's in a burning building. Like, you could, like, maybe don't be so harsh. But that is the most minor of nitpicks with how he writes Superman. I was genuinely shocked, especially after those last two stories, which I didn't think were necessarily bad, but the voice that you think of when you think of Brian Bendis comics is young Peter Parker. You know, it's the Ultimate Spider-Man book that he wrote for 100 issues.
It's a loquacious teen.
It's a back and forth conversation from loquacious teens or superheroes who talk like loquacious teens. But I really liked that. All the stuff with this dude with the weird name who wanted to blow up Krypton, not into it. 0% into it.
Rogelzar, you're talking about?
Yeah, that's him. I like, and again, I don't necessarily think that Bendis is doing a bad version. He's got the quintessence in there, and dog, you know I love the quintessence. That's weird 1990s DC Comics nonsense. Of course I love the quintessence. But that's a story that's been done, and it's going to be very tough for him to put a new spin on, but what if a dude blew up Krypton? And what if a dude blew up Krypton? Is it an interesting Superman story to me? So it's really weird that we get all this really good Superman stuff, and then we get this stuff that I'm not interested in at all, and we also get no Lois, which is building a house on sand.
Well, I'm sure we're building to Lois. It's very intentional that Lois is out of the picture, at least at the Daily Planet. She does show up at the very end of this issue at their home. Mm-hmm. Her not being in the Daily Planet, I feel like is certainly going to pay off in some way. I think his Clark voice is right on. I think his Superman voice is right on. Some other characters are a little more Bendis-y.
I didn't care for Perry.
Perry is a little more Bendis-y. The part of the issue that hit me as particularly Bendis-y is the conversation near the beginning between Firefly and Killer Moth.
That I actually didn't mind.
I don't mind it, but it was the most Bendis-y conversation in the issue.
It was the most Bendis-y, but I also thought it was fun. It, like, and I am a Killer Moth fan. Like, I think Killer Moth deserves a little more respect, but I thought, like, if you're gonna throw two Batman villains into Metropolis, then that's an interesting way to do it, and it's an interesting way to get that signature style of Bendis into that book without it coming from Superman and Lois, you know?
Yeah. But for the most part, I think the characterization of Superman and the situations he's put in this issue are quite good. Even the interaction with the firefighter that he has.
The firefighter whose name is a double M.
A double M instead of a double L.
Instead of a double L. I'm sure that was intentional. I'm sure that was absolutely intentional. Because she wouldn't have an alliterative name if it wasn't. But that still got me. That still got me like, that's not the way it should be.
Her name is Melody Moore.
Melody Moore. That's so... It turns me into such a terrible comics fan where I'm like, no, that's not the way it is. And I should say, by the way, I actually think Jason Fabok and Ivan Reis did a really great job on this
book. Okay, I wanted to talk about that because I was thinking about it the entire time I was reading this. I got a real Astro City Brent Anderson vibe from this.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't considered it until you said it, but yeah.
Not what I was expecting, but I like it.
Yeah, no, I think it really works. There's a direct Byrne homage to Byrne's Man of Steel number one, which is one of my all-time favorite Superman comics. Like, it's a shame John Byrne sailed off into the ocean and was never heard from again after Darkseid Galactus the Hunger. But yeah,
it's really bad. It's really too bad that John Byrne and Frank Miller both fell off the side of the earth.
Mysteriously vanished in sometime in 1993. But like, I think the, like, artistically, this book was really, really fun. Like, I liked it a lot.
I don't know if it's an intentional look, like kind of Brent Anderson-y look, or if it's just kind of what Ivan Reis's art style has become.
Yeah, and Reis does the majority of this book. He does the first 20 pages, and then Jason Fabok does the last two. But yeah. Reis, like, does a good, solid, friendly-looking Superman, you know?
It's really good. He's got, without being a caricature of Christopher Reeve, he's got that sensibility about him. We just know that Rogelzar is coming. Like, it keeps flashing back to Rogelzar. He's going to blow up Krypton, and he's going to be the guy that did it. And there doesn't need to be a guy that did it. This is all the ingredients of great Superman stuff with that one bad story idea.
I'm going to make a public bet with you right now.
Okay.
I will Venmo you $2 if we get through this entire series without Rugalzar claiming that he is the Man of Steel of the title.
So you're saying it will happen?
It will happen. That is my prediction.
I mean, I don't want to take that bet because I'm pretty sure that's going to happen.
It's $2, Matt. Come on. Shake with me on it. Venmo me.
All right. We'll do it. But I'm pretty sure you're going to win that bet.
Okay.
In another big Milestone comic, not from the publisher Milestone Comics, but a Milestone in numbering.
I would love if there was a new Milestone comic out this week, actually.
Yeah. Amazing Spider-Man number 800 came out. It is not Dan Slott's last issue. He's got one more.
Oh, what? Really?
Yep.
Okay, I did not realize that reading this, because it's very much like this is the one you want to go out on.
This is the greatest hits.
Yeah, it's got it all.
He's playing all the hits. Major character death, you got it.
Yeah, you do. Funeral? Funeral illustrated by Marcus Martin? You got it.
You got it. Really fucking great Stuart Immonen art. You got that too.
Yeah.
Doc Ock appearance? You got it. Call back to the Doc Ock Aunt May relationship.
Which you know we love.
You got goblins. You know you got that.
You got so many symbiotes.
Oh, boy.
You got spider slayers.
You got anti-venom.
You got guns.
You got Eddie Brock.
You got Aunt May. You got Mary Jane using her repulsor technology that she has now.
You got Peter wearing the Venom symbiote.
Uh-huh.
And going a little nutty and turning into, like, fucking Eddie Brock Venom for a second.
Yeah, like turning into Todd McFarlane Venom.
That happens.
You know what you don't have?
What don't you have?
You don't lift anything heavy.
There is no lifting a thing, and I think that's by virtue of the issue moving so super fast.
It really does move. It's a weirdly dense and kind of breezy 80 pages. Like, there's a lot going on here.
Here's why I think that is. Because it's very clearly divided into four parts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really four single issues slapped together into an 80-page story.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like a four-part storyline in a single issue.
Which I'm fine with.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not saying that's a problem. I'm just saying that's why it feels like it moves the way it does.
Now, I got this digitally, Matt. Did you get it physically or digitally?
Digitally also, yes.
Okay, because I don't know, like, if this one was, like, bound like a paperback, or if it came out stapled, or what.
Yeah, I don't know either. It could have that perfect binding, depending on how thick the paper was, or what the paper stock was, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it is a hefty issue of comics, and it does a lot. There's, like, good J. Jonah Jameson shit in here. On the real. Like, it feels like every character gets served.
Yeah, it really does.
With the exception of a couple of characters that Dan Slott has brought into the fold in his run on Spider-Man, it mostly feels like every character gets a moment.
Matt, when you were a kid, did you have that paperback, The Very Best of Spider-Man, that had the kind of yellow cover with the webs?
I think I did, yeah.
Okay, I had that when I was a kid, and I literally read it until the binding fell apart. This single issue is like a sequel to that book.
You're not off the mark, man.
Because that thing came out in, like, 1994, so it had Normie Osborn in it. You know it had Normie Osborn, and I have not thought about Normie Osborn in quite some time.
Oh, brother. I think about Normie Osborn all the time.
Hey, I was not caught up on Spider-Man. I'm not caught up on Spider-Man. I just read this issue because it was out this week. And it is, you know, it'll catch you right up if you know who Spider-Man is. I feel like I would have caught up on Spider-Man if anybody told me Norman Osborn was Carnage.
Well, that's a recent development. That's a very recent development.
That's some shit I'd be excited about.
Yeah. Yeah, the Red Goblin stuff shockingly works really well.
Yeah, and Spider-Man's way that he defeats him is very clever. Like, it's a fun comic, man.
Baiting Norman Osborn's ego is the Spider-Man thing. It's another Spider-Man greatest hit. Like, this thing is full of Spider-Man greatest hits.
Yeah, and not to spoil every single thing about it, but Spider-Man being like, yeah, Norman, you know me. You know I'm the world's biggest screw-up, and I beat you all the time. Is very good Spider-Man.
I thought the issue was, in large part, very enjoyable. With some a handful of dialogue lines I would cut out, because it is a little overly wordy. With the exception of those, I think it was, across the board, very well done. Very good. And really good art all the way through. We talked about Marcus Martin and Stuart Immonen, but also Giuseppe Comunicoli, who's done a ton of Dan Slott's Spider-Man run, has two of the stories in here. He does two big chunks of book. And then Nick Bradshaw, who also did really good work in there. All right, Chris, one more comic. That's Doomsday Clock number 5.
Yeah, man. It's a bummer.
Here's the thing about this particular issue.
I got a thing about this one.
Okay, hit me.
Well, I got a couple things. First of all, it's weird that you can say shit in a comic that has Superman in it.
I mean, you know, I don't know that this is the first time it's happened.
I don't think it's the first time it's happened. It's still very weird. I don't think you should be able to do that, maybe. I'm old now. The other thing is that Killer Frost is in this comic. And if this comic is meant to be set in the... Like, is this comic set in the DC universe? Like, is this happening?
It's an alternate DC universe, almost certainly.
Like, it would almost have to be, because that Killer Frost doesn't exist in the current DC universe. And I know that, because I read DC Comics. I feel like maybe some people putting this comic out should read DC Comics. They're pretty good now.
The current DC universe also doesn't have like the anti-superhero laws that are in this.
Yeah,
it's pretty clearly different.
No, this is in the DC universe because the fucking button happened in the DC universe.
But this is a different. This is a different DC universe.
Is it though?
This is a DC universe where Lois Lane still works for the Daily Planet. Talking to Lex Luthor about the Superman theory. And you've got all these anti-superhero laws happening. It's a similar but distinct DC universe.
I think all that stuff is just supposed to be happening in the DC universe in the pages of Doomsday Clock. I just think this book is... I just think they put the wrong Killer Frost in it, let's say. I don't know. I don't know anymore. I don't know.
All right. I generally think that the story... I don't know. I think tonally, it's off the mark in so many ways.
That's fair.
This is an issue that's called There Is No God. That's the title.
You know what I didn't realize until this issue, and I feel like an idiot?
What?
Doomsday Clock is DC.
Yeah, it's DC.
Yeah.
Here's what gets me about it, though. There are good ideas buried in here. The idea of a superhero arms race is kind of brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they did it in Justice League International and Suicide Squad 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's. I'm not saying this is the first time it's ever happened.
Look, I'm just being mean because this comic bums me out.
But the notion that there would be this theory that the U.S. government created all these heroes, that's why so many superheroes are in America and not in other countries, and so the other countries are going out of their way to create new superheroes so that they can be competitive in having the new weapon of the day, is not a bad idea.
Yeah.
It's just couched in this very weird fucking story that has Rorschach in it.
Rorschach 2.
Rorschach 2.
That dude's in Who's Who under Rorschach 2.
Yeah, it has Rorschach in it, and he finds a Green Lantern, like the actual lantern.
Boy, Matt Wilson. My eyes, I saw that page where Rorschach picks up the Green Lantern power battery, and I went, doesn't look like anything to me.
All right, that's going to do it for our comic segment. For this week, Chris, it's time for us to talk to Michelle Fife.
That sounds like a fun time. Joining us for the program this week is a creator that we're always excited about, no matter what he's working on. But you probably know him best from Copra, one of my favorite comics. His upcoming book is Bloodstrike Brutalists, which I'm very excited about. Michel Fife is here. How are you today?
Hey, guys. What's going on? It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's been a few years since you've stopped by.
Yeah, it's been – yeah, yeah. It's – I don't know what, but I guess I've been just holed up in my studio, just drawing the whole time. No, I see you once in a while at conventions, though. But yeah, by and large, I haven't been on the show since like 3-4 years or something. But I figured, you know, it was time to come out and talk about my new book.
Check and see if you see your shadow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
if there's something new coming. Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising because one of the things we talked about last time was that you were in that, I guess it was that first or second year of Copra, like you were doing like a full on, like one man band schedule to get that book done.
Yes. Yeah.
It seemed like madness to me because I get tired writing. I get done writing and I want to go to bed.
I know. I can't think about it for too much, man. Cause it's just, then I'll just stop. You know, if I think about like the actual page count that I have to produce, I'll just stifle myself and nothing will get done. But yeah, I think last we spoke, that was right when I was about to start writing for Marvel. And that's sort of when my Copra production slowed down a little bit, you know, because I had to juggle both things. So, but that first year was just breakneck, was just like, get it out the door no matter what. And that's probably why I can't really look back on those early issues, you know, for too long. Just because I see are like the mistakes, you know, or like the things that I could have done better. But whatever, that's the nature of that forward progression, you know, the sort of production schedule that I set up for myself. But yeah, I mean, it's all good. It's all good.
Is that something that you feel like kind of fueled you to get things done in a way that you wouldn't do? Like that you had that kind of time pressure and, you know, like whether it's the way you had it in your head or not, like you've got to move on to the next page now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That was the main thing actually. Cause before it was just, I would just noodle on stuff forever and nothing would get done. So this was that was sort of the thing I had set up for myself, like just get it done no matter what. And, you know, 12 issues later, it was, I had a thing, I had a big stack of pages and then I decided to continue. And that's when I had to juggle a bunch of other stuff, you know, cause I wasn't really expecting other stuff to happen, you know. So and so at this point, you know, cut to a few years later, you know, Bloodstrike is one of those things, you know, one of the things I'm juggling between Copra arcs, you know, but Copra's still going on for sure. It's just taking a little break right now so I could work on other things.
That is honestly one of the things that made Bloodstrike, your stuff on Bloodstrike coming up, so interesting to me, because I feel like there's a kind of direct connection to that unfiltered comic stuff that you were getting into with Copra, which I love. I mean, we've talked about it. You know that's my jam.
Yeah.
And then the only other two times that I feel like comics were that unfiltered were like 1940
right.
And 1991.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. I hope I could even like tap into that sort of thing But I don't know, Copra, yeah, Copra was kind of inspired by a bunch of elements, right? Like that sort of approach to just, you know, not really caring too much and just going for it, right? The 90s sort of had a part in that, but it's not as obvious because, you know, the obvious influence is, you know, like 80s DC comics or like 70s underground comics or alternative comics, right? But the 90s, I mean, even in the earliest issues of Copra, you could sort of see, if you look for it, there's like little blips of 90s-ness, you know what I mean? Like, I still like that stuff, but I was still trying to process the other things, the other sources of inspiration. So cut to, I don't know, a few issues later or a few arcs later, you start seeing the 90s influence a little bit more. I start reading those comics again, some of them for the first time, just kind of like completing my collection and just sort of like embracing that whole aesthetic, right? And not ironically, because fuck that, like really loving the stuff. Maybe it's part nostalgic, but maybe not. I'm really seeing it with a fresh set of eyes because I really appreciate the sort of verve that those comics had, you know. I kind of want to, I don't want to say energy because that's sort of like the polite way to talk about stuff you don't like. Like, oh, that art really had a lot of energy, but you really hate it. Like, that's not what I mean. Like, I really think those comics had a lot of personality and something going for it that I wanted to inject into my comics. And I did so little by little. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, like, I do. It is kind of the polite way, but I do feel like that's the word because I go back to Golden Age books a lot. And the thing that always hooks me about them is that even when they're bad, and Golden Age comics are frequently very bad, and until recently with, you know, stuff like the Craig Yeo Project, stuff like the public domain comics, like getting Stardust back out there, I think we only kind of looked back at what were the most technically accomplished Golden Age comics, mm-hmm. you know, like Siegel and Schuster, Kirby and Simon,
right.
Jack Cole, like those were the things that we really had. But then you dig a little deeper and you get this thing where everybody's trying to get Superman money and nobody knows how to do what they're doing.
Right.
And so there is a kind of appeal to that where it's just no one knows the rules yet. So they're just trying anything. And I feel like that kind of energy is what you get from the Golden Age. But when you get to the 90s, and I think we're in a really interesting spot right now because it finally has gotten to the point where the nostalgia is kicking in. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like we're all at the age where we want to remember the stuff that was around when we were like 10 or 15.
Yes.
That energy of kind of rule breaking is there in a really interesting way. Like I think the archetypical Rob Liefeld story for me is the one where he draws that Hawk and Dove issue sideways.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Carl Kiesel has to like light box it to get it back right side up. And so when he goes to Marvel, he does the sideways issue of X-Force.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, because nobody wanted to go sideways. 4 years later, Neil Gaiman did it and everybody loved it.
Of course. Then it's art. Then it's like novel. No, I think you're right. When me and you use the word energy, we mean it from, you know, like we love that kind of material. Like we mean it in a different way than say, like, I don't know, a comics veteran might try to be polite online and they're like, oh, Rob's work has a lot of energy, you know? And I've seen it. I've seen Twitter threads and Facebook threads about that stuff. But we actually think there is a pure, awesome, raw energy to the work, to his work specifically. And I think you kind of hit upon something there between the 40s and the 90s was that, yeah, it was a bunch of kids just trying to figure shit out. But there's also the question of commerce. Like people are just trying to get the next Superman. People are just trying to, you know, make money. I mean, this is like the art versus commerce argument, you know. And where does it meet? What's a good balance? And back in the 40s, it just didn't matter. It's just like, just get the stuff done, you know. And that sort of energy lent itself to that approach to business. And yeah, you nailed it when you said the 90s were just like that, just in a different way, just on steroids, you know. The aesthetics were different. The expectations were different. And the money was bigger. I mean, you can't doubt that. So I don't know. I totally see the relation between those periods.
You get Todd and Todd McFarlane and Rob and Jim Lee, like, raking it in. And I feel like they're such weirdly unique success stories from that era, because, you know, Todd McFarlane, like, Spawn's huge, obviously, but it kind of becomes the collectibles empire.
Yes.
With Todd Toys and then McFarlane Toys. And Jim Lee gets into this position where he sells everything to DC, where DC acquires it as they, you know, as is DC's tradition going back to 1940. Mm-hmm. And then Rob just, you know, has these huge, huge projects. And then by the late 90s is turning around and being like, hey, let's do an Alan Moore Superman book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he ran that ship, you know, so any idea that he had or any collaboration that he came upon was like, why the hell not? Let's just do it. You know? So there's something cool in that, you know, and employing all those young artists, like, you know, sort of developing that talent, you know, people that still work in the industry, like, you know, to this day, they're cranking out stuff. So I think that's a super interesting point of view. The thing, man, I gotta say, I've been thinking about this, but the thing about Rob Liefeld is that he has been a punching bag since that Sideways issue. Like, even his editors weren't on his side. Like, you could say Bob Harris with the X-Men stuff, you know, he was on his side, but after a while, but why do you think Youngblood happened, you know? And no matter what, like, people are reluctant to give him props, to, like, give him any sort of credit for, you know, the fans are a different story. Because, you know, the movies and the toys and the merchandising and the comics, you know, we all love Rob and support him. But when it comes to, like, his peers or the industry, man, that guy must have the thickest fucking skin. Because it's like it hasn't stopped. No one's given him a break. You know what I mean? Do you see that? Am I just making that up?
Oh, no. That is absolutely
like, that's crazy. No one has gone through that at all. Like, even Todd, reluctantly, people might make fun of his Spider-Man stuff. Like, oh, you know, the story's terrible. He can't write, but at least the art's pretty. Like, they at least give him that. You know what I mean? Rob doesn't even get that at all. So that's just fucking weird.
I certainly feel like if I saw Rob on Twitter being sort of embittered or at least crabby, I could understand it, which makes his overwhelming positivity that much kind of more mind-blowing when you see it.
Oh, yeah. Once a week, I follow Rob on Twitter, and I followed Rob on Twitter before I was working with him, you know, before we had Deadpool, before Chad had Youngblood, because it is – I will send Aiden something once a week because it is relentlessly positive and charming. Even if I don't agree with it, he's always like, I think my favorite tweet was just the words Darth Maul with 4 exclamation points.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, Rob's excited about Darth Maul. That's great.
I know, man. I know. He's so positive, and it's not phony. It's not cynical. It's not a put on. Like, he loves this stuff. He loves stuff more than, like, I mean, I don't love stuff, you know, sometimes I'm a cranky old shithead, you know, and it's like, he loves stuff. He really does. And he makes me think, like, give things double takes, like, oh, maybe I'll consider that. Maybe I was wrong about this comic or this movie. So I love that sort of energy, that sort of force. I love it.
Well, I came up writing about comics in the mid 2000s, you know, on a comics blog. And so I will say I made plenty of Rob jokes. Because I was young and pretentious,
right,
in my own weird way.
Right.
But the thing that brought me around, and I had a very kind of public coming around on Rob, and I wrote about it and being like, no, actually Rob's awesome. Like, actually Youngblood's good. Like, back in, you know, 2009, 2010. And what did it was seeing that interview where he talked about an editor telling him that he didn't deserve the success he was getting.
Yeah.
And that blew my mind, because you can't determine that. Like, how could you say that if Rob's on, like, if Rob's the one drawing the book, plotting the book, you know, creating a handful of those characters, you know, like, how could you possibly tell that dude that he didn't deserve to sell 5 million copies when that's exactly what happened? And from there, I kind of worked backwards to the idea that there, you know, like, no, actually, these books are good and there is something of value here. And that's when I went back to them and started going back to like early 90s stuff completely unironically.
Right.
And I do think that there's certainly a place for Doom Force. I still think Doom Force is funny. But, you know, like, there's also a place for Bloodstrike, for Youngblood, for X-Force, for all those books.
Right, right. Also, he was 20, right? Like, he was, like, 20, 21 creating stuff, and it was hitting. It was totally landing with people. You know, you can't argue with that. You know, that was just a bitter editor trying to get under his skin. But again, it goes to my point, like, he barely has any of those people on his side, so it's just kind of strange, but whatever. But you're right. I mean, you go back to those, you know, properties, those books, and there's a charm there. Even if it's not your thing, there's like something to it. And that's what attracted it to me again. I mean, like you said, you know, we sort of, when we come up reading certain comics, we kind of go through a period of outgrowing them when we discover stuff. And you said, you know, you were pretentious about it. And I actually remember something, you said something like Chris Ware's the most boring comic ever, like the most boring cartoonist ever. And I love that.
I still think that.
Because that was your pretentious, I guess, point of view. I don't think it's pretentious, but you know what I mean? That was you developing your point of view, and you had to go through that, and you had to go through not liking Rob Liefeld stuff, and then coming back and rediscovering that, oh, that's actually great. And I did the same thing. I mean, I stopped liking all the stuff I grew up on, you know, and I had to come around it. And Copra was kind of part of that, you know? Yeah, and not that I hated Suicide Squad, but it was just never discussed. It was never in the discussion, you know what I mean? Like, no one ever cited it. No one talked about how great Norm Breakvogel was, you know? No one talked about any of these comics that I really deeply loved. And I'm like, why the fuck aren't people talking about it? How come this energy isn't being channeled somehow? And, you know, it was a long process. This wasn't like night and day, but it was like years of me just kind of shedding my own pretensions of thinking that graphic novels were like the end-all, be-all delivery system for comics, which you could think that, you know, there's room in comics for all sorts of points of views. And that's precisely my point. It's like, why not tap into that previous energy that excited us before, you know? So that's part of Copra, and that's certainly, hopefully, part of Bloodstrike.
Well, what hooked me on Copra initially was that nobody talked about Suicide Squad for 15 years after it ended.
Nobody.
You know?
Nobody.
Nobody talked about it. Nobody, like, John Ostrander was not like a big name writer by the end of the 90s, even though he was still working. Like, he and Mandrake did the Martian Manhunter series, but nobody was talking about how great those classic runs were, and DC certainly wasn't reprinting them.
Right.
But then you look at what happens at DC Comics in the 2000s, and Suicide Squad's the foundation. And not just for, like, the good stuff. You know, there's Checkmate, there's Secret Six, there's all these books that are directly influenced. There's Deadshot coming back as a major villain. But there's, you know, all the bad stuff is kind of built on Suicide Squad, too, because it is that morally gray, anti-hero stuff, more violent superheroes, more quote-unquote realistic or grounded supervillains and superheroes. Mm-hmm. And that's all stuff that really kicks in with Suicide Squad that, you know, Ostrander and Kim Yale and Luke McDonnell were very capable of pulling off, and then a lot of lesser talent wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, that's being very generous, but yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it had that – it was the next wave, and nobody was ready for it, and then nobody likes the thing that just finished. You know, I think Fraction said that once. Like no song sounds older right now than Call Me Maybe. Like, it's still a banger, but no song is as dated as that one is.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Nobody likes the thing that just finished. And for a lot of us coming up in the 90s and reading, like, Wizard magazine, which all of us read, nobody hated the thing that just happened like Wizard did. They were always excited about what was happening right now, and they hated what happened last year.
Oh, totally. If they could sniff cancellation, they would just – I mean, you're destroyed. You're garbage to them.
Yeah.
And I think Suicide Squad was part of that. And a lot of comics I like from back in the day, as I was buying them in real time, was part of that, you know. And Suicide Squad, I mean, even when Ostrander came back and wrote that mini, remember, what's it called, From the Ashes?
Yeah, it was called From the Ashes, but it said Raise the Flag on the cover.
Yeah, it was weird. And, you know, I don't think the art did it justice. I thought it was an awesome story. He still had chops, but you still got the sense like, who cares? You know, no one's, or even then, even if they did care, it's like, well, who cares about the old stuff? This is the new thing. This is a new 8-issue thing that ties into whatever current storyline we have. So yeah, Suicide Squad sort of had this, this weird energy to it. Right. But I remember meeting Tucker Stone, and we started talking about Suicide Squad almost instantly. It was weird because, again, I'd never met anyone who knew the reference, you know, who knew like a Captain Cold line from an issue. And I'm like, holy shit, this guy's my best friend. I knew it. And then that was already like, you know, reading old Deadshot comics and old Suicide Squad comics. That was all sort of in rotation in my studio, right? So that sort of momentum was building and building and building until Copra happened, you know, this sort of desire to see these characters again. And no offense to anyone, but you know, New 52 happened, some hits, some misses, not for everyone, not for me. But I gave Suicide Squad a shot, you know, and it just wasn't recognizable. And I understand that not everything has to sort of be for me. You know, you don't have to replicate my past, you know, my childhood. You know, I don't need that. I have the old comics. I'm fine. I could reread those anytime. But I saw the concept of Suicide Squad being handled in this way where I thought, huh, like it's not doing it for me, you know, and in some sort of weird, bold move, I just thought, well, fuck it, let me try it. It's never going to happen officially, so let me just tweak a couple of things and see what happens. And it went from there. I just sort of took the energies I had in making my own alternative indie comics and just channeled them into something that's inspired by, you know, old 80s comics, Nascenti's Daredevil, you know, Steve Gerber's Defenders, like all sorts of kooky shit. Anything I liked was a good thing to cite and sort of use as a reference. And that's where Copra came. And, you know, to connect it to Liefeld, that's sort of what he does. I mean, I look back and I'm like, well, Liefeld's Youngblood came from sort of Teen Titans, right? You know, all of Alan Moore's work comes from something. You know, there's a direct line of reference. The thing is, I just did it from my room. You know, I just did it. I just self-published it because, you know, no one's going to pick that up. I mean, especially at that time, like you said, the stink of the Suicide Squad, I couldn't use that as a reference point. I'm not going to be like, oh, it's sort of like that. But in my style, like that would never have caught on. So I had the foresight for that. And so I did it myself anyway. You know, I just put it out because you can, because comics are sort of this super affordable commodity. You could just do it. The stakes are low enough where you could take that sort of risk. And I figured after 12 issues, whatever, I'd still have a good chunk of comics done if it goes nowhere.
Well,
but luckily for me, it's still something that I'm still developing, you know, I'm like in the middle of, so.
Well, talking about that DIY approach, mm-hmm. like that's something that wasn't necessarily a necessity, I guess, but that you felt very compelled to do with Copra. But since then, you've had opportunities to take on, you know, more singular roles, either as strictly the artist working with a writer, or as strictly a writer, like on All New Ultimates. But you're doing everything again with Bloodstrike. Your name is the name on the cover.
Right.
Did you feel like something in that particular property necessitated that sort of singular vision? Because, you know, when Rob was doing the book, it was all Rob, more or less. So did you feel like this needed to be all you, your version?
Yes. I mean, to backtrack a little bit, I do like collaboration, but I don't prefer it. I think I work quicker and more efficiently if I'm just doing it all myself. And in collaborating with other people, whether it be writers or artists, it's just, again, the process is pretty slow. And it's fine. I actually like teamwork, and I actually want to do it in the future. I kind of want to be a part of a larger team. But for Bloodstrike's purposes, I thought it best for me to just do it all myself, not only for efficiency, but because I'm juggling all the things, all the nuances of the story myself, because it's very continuity heavy. That's a thing. It's patching up a lot of holes in the history of the publishing line. It's got a huge cast of characters, and I'm trying to make it into one thing. So I thought it'd be just easier and quicker to just get it done myself and sort of develop more work that's just on me, you know, as opposed to just having Copra be that thing. I kind of wanted to show that I could do that Copra thing on other properties and have it succeed and have it be a thing, you know, have it be a workable situation. So when I work on Bloodstrike, or when I did like a short Daredevil story for Secret Love, that was sort of me reemerging, I guess, as a complete sort of creator. But it was also showing those audiences that, yes, I do all those things, you know, and you get a different result out of it as opposed to like if I had a whole team to work with and manage, or you know, I could never have interns or assistants or anything, just because I couldn't. It would just slow the process down. And maybe I'll slow down eventually, but you know, just the nature of these issues, they just require constant movement, you know? So, I mean, you know, Chris, you've collaborated with people, you know how long it takes to sort of get notes back and get things signed off. I mean, you know, it takes forever.
Yes. There's always a tension. I was going to say a fight, but it's not that bad. It's not that bad. Usually there's always like a little, you know, there's a push and pull to it. Yeah. That, you know, I mean, you say anybody can do it. You specifically can do it because you're an extremely good artist and writer.
Well,
like I can't do it. I can't sit down in my room and make the new version of I don't know, the Alan Grant, Norm Brayfogle Batman would be a right. 90s comic I would go back to. So how did that path sort of lead you to Bloodstrike?
Oh, actually, it was actually last year. You know, I'd sort of been collecting a bunch of different comics, and Extreme Comics were on the list. You know, I was looking through bins on my way to Heroes Con, and I was just sort of rereading the stuff I had and, you know, filling my collection and just kind of like taking the whole universe all at once and falling in love with it again, you know? And Bloodstrike was a thing that stood out because I remember loving it back in the day. You know, that was the one book. I just like Brigade was cool, but I loved Bloodstrike. You know what I mean? So those issues, you know, there was a 2-issue hole in the publishing industry. And I thought, you know, as an exercise, I sort of thought to myself, like, what would I do if I could, you know, take those plot points and sort of tie them up and neatly deliver them somehow? Would that be compelling to like a new reader? And that's where the challenge came in. Like, well, maybe if I could make it and write it in a way and draw it in a way that it would still look cool, that would be enough. And it would kind of put, you know, my nerd frustrations of continuity to rest, you know. And so I developed a 0-issue and an issue 23 and 24. And I titled it Brutalists. That would be like the Brutalists parts 1, 2, and 3. But really, it's issues 0, 23, and 24 of the original run. So it's like, you know, you could easily put them, you know, if you have like a long box and you have your comics, you could easily put them in those slots. I don't think anyone's going to do that. I mean, I might do that, but that's where it came from. Just me like bin diving essentially and being obsessive about stuff, about old comics.
If we could talk about art style for a minute, I'm amazed by what I've seen of Bloodstrike and how it's so clearly your art style. Like, you're not doing a Rob impression per se. Mm-mm. But it does have those Rob Liefeld elements that aren't necessarily a part of your art elsewhere, like in Copra, Like, it's got that cross-hatching, and the characters are a little wider and gruffer than they look in Copra. So I'm wondering if you could speak to how you achieved that balance of, you know, adding those elements into your art without feeling like you were doing, you know, a Liefeld impression.
Man, that's funny because I've been slowly going in that direction for a while, just like little by little, you know, like, it, you know, putting a little crosshatch here, doing a little shine there. And then this was the perfect opportunity to go all out, you know, draw every vein on that neck and draw all the biggest muscles I could, within reason, you know, within my style, because I do not want to cross that line where it's like parody, you know, where it's like, I'm not trying to cite a specific, you know, I don't want to ghost Rob, you know, that's his style. And I love that style and that's him. I want to sort of tap into that specific thing that he does. That's different, you know? So I don't want to mime it. I just want to sort of utilize it for my own ends. And Bloodstrike, of course, being the perfect vehicle for that. But I just started studying that stuff anyway. Like, I just wanted the sort of, I don't know, swagger that stuff had. It was just exciting. And that just gave me the perfect opportunity, really, to look at the old comics I had and dissect what I liked about them, which is fun for me. You know, it doesn't sound like fun, but for me, it's like that. I love doing that, you know, not just reading the stories and revisiting characters, but kind of seeing why I liked them, you know, what compelled me to them. Right. And I found that a lot of that Liefeld stuff just had it, man. And I just wanted to sort of put that on the page. And like you said, in little ways, like whether it be through actual, you know, cross hatching or inking techniques, but there's also like a weird philosophy behind it, you know, like just make it like I gave myself a rule for Bloodstrike, which is not a bad rule to have, but it's just make it look cool. Just why not make it look fucking cool? That's it. It's so, it's so simple. So every page I wanted something cool to have, something that I think is cool, you know? So even in say like a quiet, boring page, quote unquote boring, I wanted to have an element that made it pop somehow, whether it be through the color or the art or layout or even the writing, but it all had to just go the extra mile. You know what I mean? Just give it that little something extra. And I think that came from studying that 90s stuff, man, to be honest, you know, mostly Liefeld, mostly McFarlane. I like all the other guys, but those two are kind of the ones that you look at the actual evidence in the printed page. And they did precisely that, you know.
There's a lot I want to talk about, and time is growing shorter. But before we kick it over to Twitter questions, tell me about the pouch.
The pouch, that's right. The pouch is, man, that's a sensation. That's what the fans wanted, they got, and they're going to get in the second issue of Bloodstrike Brutalists. Yeah, that's something Rob sketched, I think, on Instagram or something. Like someone asked him to draw him a pouch, and that was kind of like a funny, clever thing to do. And he just took it to the next level and just made a complete character made out of pouches. And he's making a comic for it. So, yeah, it's going to be the next big thing.
I think now is the time that we're going to kick it over to our listeners on Twitter to see if they've got any questions for you. Matt, if people want to get in on these conversations that we have with our friends each and every week here on War Rocket Ajax, how exactly, specifically, can they go about that?
Well, Chris, it's so, so easy to do. First, look at your outfit. What are you wearing? Is there a pouch on it? If not, could it use a pouch? The answer is yes. So, brother, go get a pouch. Put a pouch on that outfit, then add another pouch. Then add another pouch. Then add another pouch. Until you are covered in pouches, my friend. And you will be carrying around so much stuff that you need in those pouches. And you'll be like, how did I live without these? Then get on your computer, remove the pouches from your hands, and go to twitter.com. Sign up for an account, like PouchLife420, and follow the ISB, that's Chris, the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and wait until usually Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time, except this week we're doing something a little different. We're on Friday afternoon, but just you know, keep an eye on things at all times and wait for the call for questions for our guest. And you can ask a question just like these you're about to hear from Michel Fife. And we're going to start with this very simple question from @SettleChaos on Twitter, CJ Crawl, who wants to know, will I be able to rub the blood?
Well, that's not very nice. It's not very nice, CJ. I don't know. Find out. Find out June 13th if you'll be able to rub the blood or not. Just go to your local comic shop. And just pick up the first issue. You'll be pleasantly surprised.
What a tease. Here's a question from cineast Ben Rowe on Twitter. He asks, where do you think the recent reappraisal of the Liefeld line of comics has come from? Have the various recent reinventions created the goodwill, or has it simply been all the 90s kids growing up and becoming creators themselves, or is it something else?
Well, I'd say just rewind to the past half hour of me just spewing love for Liefeld. But I do think, you know, the goodwill has come also of Liefeld being very supportive of creators, especially independent creators, you know, and letting them do their own thing on his books, you know, and the proof is that those books are awesome. People love those books. People love those properties. So, you know, it took those creators to sort of show the world that, hey, it's okay. It's okay to like these properties, you know, they're still awesome. You know, something cool could always be done with them. So there you go.
Here's a question from Pedro Valor on Twitter, Peter Velez, who asks, how much neon lighting is too much neon lighting?
Not enough. It's never enough.
Never enough.
Oh my God. You look at those old Brian Murray colors from those old Image comics. Holy shit. That's like my, that's my standard right there.
Here's a question from Entropy Agent on Twitter, Josh, who wants to know, what video store era VHS action movie would you most love to do a modern day comic adaptation for? And that is a question for all three of us.
Oh my God. That's so loaded, that question.
There's so many to choose from. So many to choose from.
I know. I think my go-to would have to be RoboCop. RoboCop. I've drawn him before. I love that movie to death. I love him to death. And I just want to draw all those scenes all over again.
Matt, do you have one?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
It's Gymkhana.
Yeah. Yeah, damn it. Should have gone first.
Fuck.
I've co-written two Army of Darkness comics already, and I know that's 1992, but it has a history that extends back to the 80s.
That sort of counts.
Yeah. Man, Gymkhana, though, what is the deal with that little country?
I don't know, but the reason I would jump at Gymkhana is that I don't have to draw it, because I can't. So yeah. I'm going to make somebody else draw the gymnastics and karate together.
Panel one, we're looking at a city. Don't make it obvious, but everything could potentially be upon a horse.
Now it's time for Character Corner, the part of Warrock and Ajax Twitter questions where fictional characters ask questions of our guests. This one is from Real Kunzeit on Twitter, who asks you, Michel Fife, how do I appeal to the extreme youths today?
How does that person want to appeal to them? Oh God, I have no idea. I don't know the point of reference. I don't know what this guy's going for, or lady. But how I would appeal to the extreme youth is to, I don't know. Have just splash pages on every page. You know, up the resale value of those pages. Fuck it, why not?
If I could offer one bit of advice to anyone wanting to appeal to the extreme youths of today, be real. Just be real.
Nah.
Like from Cypress Hill?
Yeah, like from Cypress Hill. That's the one. okay, that's it for character order.
Extreme youths also, we're really talking about 40-year-old men, right?
That's probably true, yes. All right, that's it for Character Corner. This one is from Rank and Vilecast on Twitter, who asks, which is the best Death Wish sequel?
I'd have to say part two. Wait, how many are there? Six or something?
There's quite a few.
Many Death Wish movies.
There is a right answer to this, I will say.
I mean, two is only the one I remember the most. That's only why I answered two. I don't know. Maybe four is like the magical one, but...
There are five...
You can't really beat the first one.
There are five movies and then the 2018 remake.
The correct answer to that question is, of course, Death Wish 3, which is full on bananas.
Oh, which one's that one? What happens?
That's
then?
The one. That's basically the one where Charles Bronson kills like 100 people who are in like a Warriors Mad Max gang. In the city, and it has my favorite, one of my favorite moments in a movie, which is where the lead bad guy who is in a gang and he has kind of like the hawk from the Road Warriors reverse mohawk.
Oh fuck!
Why have
I not seen this?
Charles Bronson kills a bunch of dudes, and then the guy gets on the phone, and this is what he says in the way that he says it. Hi, yeah, this is Manny Fraker. I'm gonna need some more dudes. It's perfect.
It's worth noting that the first Death Wish movie was produced by the Dino De Laurentiis Corporation.
Uh-huh.
The next three were the Canon Group.
The best. So
that lets you know the quality level of those movies.
And Charles Bronson was contractually obligated.
I think this is going to be our last turn of question, and it's another loaded question. This is from CJ Tour, who wants to know, for all of us, favorite death in Suicide Squad?
Oh, man. Favorite death. Is that just for me or for everyone? Come on, Chris.
For
you
got to
jump in on this.
That's for all of us.
Well, I would say that – I would say Slipknot, except I never saw the body, right? He recovered actually, right?
Yeah.
He didn't really die. He was – okay. To me, he was retconned to live, but because I think he died in the swamps without an arm. But – I don't know. Let me think about that.
I mean,
we hear the explosion, but we don't see Slipknot's body.
None of the deaths are permanent, so we can't use permanence as a factor.
I got one, and it was permanent. Grant Morrison,
about the writer.
Yes,
I'm talking about the writer.
Yes,
that's the best death in Suicide Squad. It's the funniest. It's the best.
I think my choice is what I would consider to be probably the most shocking death in the whole series. Which is when Rick Flag eats it.
That's – or did he?
It was also retconned by John Ostrander himself. So spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read.
That shit in Suicide Squad 25 is good as hell though. I love the design for that for Jotunheim. The weird like inverted pyramid at the side of the cliff fort.
Yeah.
That thing is awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man. Those issues are – God damn it, guys. Now I'm going to have to read those things again. Oh, no. You know what my favorite death is? I got to say it. It's when Duchess rips off the Manticore's tail and beats him to death with it.
Yeah, that's a good one. Look.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's so many. I mean, yeah, you're totally right. This is a loaded question because we could just go off on this forever.
I just want to say, because it's been on my mind since we were talking about it earlier, that was the problem with New 52 Suicide Squad, is they put characters they were never going to kill in it. The thing that makes Suicide Squad work is that it was a bunch of people nobody gave a shit about.
Right.
Deadshot totally. Wasn't popular in 1987.
Yeah, at all.
Yeah, Mindboggler, you're not that surprised when Mindboggler dies.
Yeah. Or does she?
Ooh.
All right, I think that's going to be it for Twitter questions. Before we get out of here, Michel Fife, where can everybody find you online and your books, should you wish to be found?
You guys could go to my website, just michelfife.com. I have everything listed there, pretty easy to find. But on Twitter, I'm at Michel Fife. On Instagram is mfife, and pretty much everywhere else too. Facebook, under my name. I'm pretty easy to find though.
All right, our guest... has been Michel Fife. If you haven't read Copra, read Copra. Obviously, we've been telling you that for years. But Bloodstrike Brutalists is out this month from Image Comics. Starts with number 0, continues in number 23. So pick it up. It's going to be good stuff. Man, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you, guys.
Thanks once again to Michel Fife for coming back. That dude's comics are always top-notch, so check him out. But with that, I think we're just gonna wrap the show up. We talked a lot about comic books at the top of the show, Matt.
We sure did, and we also talked a lot about Westworld. So we're just gonna wrap up this episode. But before we get out of here,
should we have done some Weiwoboko?
Maybe we'll do some later. We'll do some Weiwoboko. Before we get out of here, though, we do want to point folks to a charity, a good cause that they can help out. Since this week the theme seems to be prisons and pardons and that kind of stuff, I want to point folks to a charity that helps people when they get out of prison to reintegrate into life on the outside and have a fighting chance of not going back to prison. That is the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, which is based out in LA, out in California, even though it is a national organization. And its main goal is to make sure that prisoners, when they get out of jail, can do constructive things back in their day-to-day life and be fulfilled and not end up going back to prison, which happens so very often to ex-convicts. So they are at antirecidivism.org, and you can go help them out and help some folks get fulfilling, thriving lives when they get out of prison, because it is something that is too rare, too rare.
That's right, Matt. And where can everybody find us online?
You can send us an email at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is where you can send every story ever list, panel president lists. If you want to ask a question, you can ask it there. Or if you want to sponsor the show or otherwise get in touch, you can do that. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Check out on Tumblr, where you can ask us a question also. That is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Also, go leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more good reviews we get there, the more we are featured. To find me individually, you can go to mattdwilson.net to find links to all my stuff, my comics, my books, my social medias, and my other podcasts. They are all there at mattdwilson.net. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find my stuff by going over to the-isb.com. There's links there to pretty much everything I do. It would be nice if you told a friend about some of the stuff that we do, if you like it, whether it's War Rocket Ajax, whether it's our other podcasts, whether it's the stuff that we write, our comics. Giving a person you know a recommendation goes a long way, as does, of course, leaving a rating or review on iTunes. That does help people find the show, but I always find that hearing from a friend is good. So that's going to do it for War Rocket Ajax number 405. Matt, I will talk to you again beforehand, but happy birthday.
Thanks, buddy. And actually, oh, someone just walked in the room, Chris.
Oh?
It's the birthday wizard.
The birthday wizard.
The birthday wizard is here. He's leaning over to say something in my ear. He said it's HQC.
Birthday wizard, bless us everyone.
See you next week, everybody.
We love you.
Yeah! Flash. Hey!